hear more a little later. And also, after I discuss some of the issues, we'll show you a short video about Colonel Yoni Steinberg, really a moving situation. So, how do I move? Thank you. So there are quite a few halachot related to war. As I said earlier, most of them stem from the Torah itself. There are several psukim concerning halachas, how to fight a war and against who to fight such a war. And there are some Talmudic sources on special laws during fighting, during war, but there's a big gap of halachas between the Talmud and the Rambam to our days, because no poskim were involved in halachas. This particular war created some new shyness that myself and others are involved in solving the problem. And one unique the aspect of this war is that there are many, Esther and other from learned soldiers and officers who ask shyness, which wasn't the reality in previous wars where the soldiers came from different sects of the community and they didn't initiate shyness. The chief rabbinate of the army did deal with some questions, but this is very unique, and I'll just give you some examples to understand how halacha is involved. So the first topic I'll discuss briefly is on the principles and definitions concerning war, and I'll show you some of the biblical and Talmudic issues that relate to war, calling for peace, a siege and the obligation to leave a corridor, what exemptions and leniencies are in an army camp because of the war, what are some of the special positive commandments, the prohibition to be afraid, a get given a priori in order to prevent a situation of aguna, and many other issues that are already ancient and discussed previously. I'll deal a little bit more on the specific issues that came up during this war, or at least during the wars of the 75 years of the existence of Israel, concerning priorities in treating wounded soldiers in a battlefield. You have one physician, two medics, and 20 wounded soldiers. Who do you take care of first? Who do you take care of second? Who don't you take care of? These are very practical issues that have to be resolved. Are we committed or forbidden to treat injured terrorists? And there are many, many of them now in Israel, and I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on. How do you identify a dead person who was burned, unfortunately, who was dismantled, who was bombed, and there are parts of him and not the whole body? How do you know who he is? There are issues of Nida and Shabbos that are very specific, and they are specifically were asked in this particular war. Again, I'll discuss it a little later. So let's start with some of the principles and definitions related to war. On the one hand, wars are undesirable. We are not a people that likes to go to fight, that certainly is the martyr that wants to get killed for some reason. That is not what Jews are all about. And indeed, we say that David HaMelech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him, you have shed much blood and have made great walls. You shall not build a temple for my name's sake. David HaMelech fought for the sake of Israel. He conquered territories in Israel so the Jews can live peacefully. Yet, because he shed so much blood, he wasn't the person chosen to build the Beit HaMikdash. His son, Shlomo HaMelech, who wasn't involved in war, he was the one who built the temple. And the Rambam, in his introduction to Masechet Avot, in the Shmona Prakim, says the reason is that fighting creates cruelty in the person who is engaged in fighting, and the temple is the opposite of cruelty. In general, peace is the most desirable aspect in a family and in a people. And the end of Shas Mishnayos, the last Mishnah, the last sentence, the last Mishnah summarizing all the Shisha Sibrei Mishnah says, the best vessel containing blessing by Hashem is peace. Lo matza kadosh baruch hu kli machzik bracha, ela shalom. So the word shalom, peace, is the last word of Shisha Sibrei Mishnah. And we know that all our prayers, all three times that we say Shmona Esrei, the last, actually the 19th bracha, we call it Shmona Esrei because before Shmuel HaKotam added the Hamashinim, there were 18 blessings, but now there's no tefillah that has 18 blessings. We have either 7 blessings on Shabbos or 19 during the weekday. But the last one is Sim Shalom. That's what we are asking. Amevarechet Amon Yisrael b'Shalom. That's how we conclude every filler of the three fillers during the day. And also the Kaddish, which is to memorize the dead people, finishes with Oseh Shalom b'Bomar, we Oseh Shalom aleinu v'al Yisrael. So Shalom, peace, is the epitome of what we are desiring to get. But nonetheless, wars happen, wars occur, and we have no control over that. And not only are wars permissible if the circumstances are applicable, but some of the wars are obligatory, are a mitzvah. So, in general, there are 17 positive and negative commandments in the Torah itself related to war. But, as we said, for 2,000 years, we didn't fulfill this mitzvah because we weren't engaged in war, and all the sources that we have are very sparse and few. Now, in any war, there is a unique requirement to behave righteously and morally during the war. And the pasuk in the Torah is, when a camp goes out against your enemies, you shall guard against anything evil. And the obvious question is, we should guard ourselves from anything evil all the time, not only during war. Why did the Torah specify that during war you have to guard yourself from anything evil? So Rashi says that the reason is that the Satan accuses during danger. When there is a dangerous situation, that's when the evil spirits come about, and you have to guard yourself more than you would have done it when everything is peaceful. But the Ramban points out another aspect, and this is when soldiers go into war, they are free from societal norms and societal obligations, And that's the time, and we know from history, soldiers that become very immoral, very cruel, very aggressive, and they misbehave. So the Torah says, in this time when everyone else would have misbehaved, you should guard yourself and you should behave correctly. And I must point out, and I'm sure that you have seen videos and clips and so on, that in the Gaza war currently conducted, we see a high spirit of morality of soldiers from all walks of life. They are united, they are doing the best not to kill innocent people, even if they are within the parameter of the war, and they behave really outstandingly, morally, and righteously. So I think this is really the epitome of what we can see fulfilling the mitzvah that you should guard yourself against anything evil. Another point that the Ramban makes is that during war, you shouldn't rely on miracles. Yes, we should pray, we should say tilim, we should support morally the soldiers, but the tactics of war should be natural tactics. Only in Yetzias Mitzrayim we find that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Hashem yilachem lachem v'atem tachrishu. God will fight for you, you stay quiet. But that was at the beginning of the nation, a slave that came out of Egypt who had no concept of being a free person and a free nation. Their miracles had to happen in order to make the nation as it was. But once we are already a nation, like any other nation, we should use tactics and intelligence and weapons that will make the war a natural war. There's an interesting pasuk that says, do not be afraid, do not panic, and do not be broken before them. There is seemingly an obligation for soldiers who go to war not to be afraid. And indeed, the Rambam holds that that is a positive commandment. You shouldn't be afraid. However, many of the poskim say that that is an impossible request. You go to war, you know what's happening there, and you shouldn't be afraid because you were commanded not to be afraid. How can you control your emotions? So they say that is not a commandment, that is a blessing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you that if you do the right thing and if you fight the right war, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help you so that you don't have to be afraid, but it's not an obligation on yourself not to be afraid because that's an impossible command. Okay, so now coming to definitions, there are two categories of wars according to halacha. There is what's called milchemet reshut, a permissible war, which for instance is to expand the territory. We live in a certain territory which was promised to Am Yisrael, and we go for a war just to expand the territory. That's called milchemet reshut. On the other hand, there are three types of wars that are milchemet mitzvah, which means they are obligatory. You have to fight them by a mitzvah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the three are the war against the seven nations at the time of Yehoshua and Shoftim, Shivat Amamim, Akhnani, Aprizi, Amori. That was a milchemet mitzvah. We had to eradicate the seven peoples who lived then in Israel in order to conquer Israel and make it a Jewish place. The second obligatory war is the war against Amalek. Amalek was attacking Israel at their weakest point just in order to kill Jews, as unfortunately through history we saw such motions, but Amalek was the first one to do it. And according to the Torah, we have to eradicate Amalek. That's a mitzvah. A third milchemet mitzvah is a war of saving Jews from enemies who attack them. If enemies attack Jews, every Jew has a mitzvah, has a commandment to go and help the Jews that were attacked and fight the enemies that attacked them. Here it is divided into two subtypes. One is once the enemy already attacked you, like for instance in the current war, they came in and attacked us, so we returned the war, which is a milchemet mitzvah to save the Jews from the attackers. But even a preventive war, if you know that they are gathering and they want to come on, to engage in a war with you, you can start the war, and that is called Bezrat Yisrael Miyatzah. If you think about it, almost all the wars in the 75 years of Israel's existence was purely Atzalat Yisrael Miyatzah. They started, we responded, and that's how the war was. Except for the Six-Day War, where we started the war after knowing that they are planning to attack us. But both are Milchemet Mitzvah. This is according to the Rambam. Nowadays, at least in Israel, but I think internationally, there is no Milchemet Rashut. None of the Milchamot was just going to war in order to expand the land. None of the wars were of this kind. Perhaps Russia-Ukraine war now is of this type, that the Russians just want to expand their territories. That would be, if we would do it, a Milchemet Rashut. But no country, no civilized country is doing it anymore, so there's no Milchemet Rashut. The seven peoples and Amalek disappeared from the face of earth. There are no more such people that we can identify, and therefore this mitzvah doesn't exist anymore. So the only war that we can fight nowadays is the war that we are fighting now, which is saving Jews from enemies who attack them. And that is the war that we are engaged in at the moment. Now, what is the fundamental halachic principle behind the permission to be engaged in war? One is a simple one that everyone comes to mind, and that is pikuach nefesh. If the Jews attack us, Jews will be killed. We are protecting ourselves, and while we are engaged in war, every minute is a pikuach nefesh. If we won't do what is needed to be done at the moment, then a soldier might be wounded or killed. So pikuach nefesh allows to violate many halachas, almost all halachas, except for three, but these are irrelevant for our discussion. So actually, every halacha can be violated in order to save ourselves, or the soldiers to save themselves, from a pikuach nefesh situation. Moreover, halacha distinguishes between pikuach nefesh of a private person in a private domain and pikuach nefesh in public. For instance, if there is something burning, a piece that is burning in the house, in a private domain, you're not allowed on Shabbos to extinguish it. Kibui is one of the lamed isurei melacha. But in public, you're allowed to extinguish it, because in public, perhaps an older person, a blind person, may be injured and even die from this obstacle, and therefore it is more lenient from a pikuach nefesh point of view to violate Shabbos in this situation. War is certainly beyond any other example of pikuach nefesh, that anything happens there is a pikuach nefesh situation. But there is more to it, and I'll give you a few examples in a minute, that war per se has different principles from a halachic point of view, and the mere fact that someone is engaged in a permissive or in an obligatory war is allowed to violate many halachas, even if at this particular moment it is not a pikuach nefesh situation. War per se allows to do things that otherwise we wouldn't do, and I'll give you a few examples. So now let's turn to some specific halachot regarding war. So I talked about priorities in treating wounded soldiers in battlefield, and interestingly, most current poskim hold that we behave on this subject other than the Mishnah and the Rambam dictates. According to the Mishnah in Horayos, prioritization or triage decisions goes by a kedusha level. So a person that has more mitzvahs obligated takes priority of a person who has less. So the Mishnah says, for instance, that a Kohen takes priority over a Levi, because a Kohen has many more mitzvahs than a Levi, and a Levi takes priority over an Israel. A man takes priority over a woman, because a man is mechuyav in more mitzvahs than a woman. So the priority goes according to the status of the kedusha. That is a Mishnah, and the Rambam brings it to the halacha. And yet, the poskim, current poskim, but Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and many of the major poskim said that nowadays we don't behave this way in prioritizing according to the Mishnah and the Rambam. One thing is because practically it's impossible. Let's say there's one physician in the field and there are 20 injured people. So what would be his obligation according to the Mishnah and Urias? He should say loud, who is a Kohen? And then he'll approach the Kohen. He says, I am a Kohen. Jews would use it, and everyone would say, I am a Kohen, right? And it's very clear. And the same for many other of these priorities, not to say that you don't have Kohanim Vadai, or all the Kohanim are only Kohanim Chazak. Anyway, it's not a practical way to save, to prioritize. And therefore, interestingly, Shlomo Zalman created a priority status which turned out to be equal to the triage decisions of armies that came to this conclusion in different eras. And that is that, first of all, if you have 20 wounded soldiers in a case of war, it can be a car accident, it can be a train accident, you go through all the wounded and you map them out according to two principles. Who is in immediate danger to life and who can be treated quickly? So these two conditions have to meet in order to prioritize a wounded. For instance, if someone has an arterial bleed, if you will leave him alone, he will die. But you can quickly save his life by putting a tourniquet and you save his life. Whereas if someone has a severe head injury and you will start to intubate him in the field and pump him with an ambo, you'll spend all your time on one soldier, all the rest will die. So it has to be something that is endangering life on the one hand, but can be taken care of quickly on the other. That's the rule that most armies adopted, and Shlomo Zalman wrote this rule from his own understanding that this is how we should prioritize. So it doesn't go by gender or by status or by economic situation. It's just a question, who can we save quicker and who without our operation will die? For instance, if someone has a cut in his finger, we don't have to take care of him, certainly not immediately. He won't die from this, and it's not so urgent to treat him. So these are some of the general rules that were adopted halachically as it is today in triage decisions in the armies. Now, treating injured terrorists. Tell you a story. In the hospital that I work at, the Charlotte Zedek, some of the Hamas terrorists who did the atrocities on October 7th were shot and wounded, and some of them ended up in Shaaretz Tzedek as well. They were dispersed all over, but they came to Shaaretz Tzedek. 200 nurses of the hospital wrote a letter to the director general that they refused to treat them. They have brothers, husbands, children in the war. Some of them were killed, and they just can't emotionally take care of such less than human beings who did such cruelty and atrocities. Halachically, they are probably right. A terrorist who killed, certainly in such a terrible fashion, doesn't deserve to live. But from a beneficial point of view, it was a mistake. And the reason that it was a mistake is that, hey, we have hostages in the hands of Hamas. If it will be known that we don't treat their wounded, not that they need this terrorists not to treat well our hostages, but they will certainly say, you didn't treat ours, we won't treat yours. And we have 136 hostages, many of them probably are wounded and sick. So that is one practical issue. Second one is that by international law of war, one has to treat the enemies who are wounded. You want them to treat your wounded, you have to treat their wounded. And if we were violating this international law, The Hague will judge us as being immoral, and next time that an officer will visit England, he will be arrested for having part in an immoral conduct of war. I'm not sure that the international law refers to terrorists. It refers to soldiers of the enemy country. A terrorist, in my view, doesn't deserve the same moral obligation. But I don't know if this is what the law says or not, and we don't want to be tested in The Hague and find out that someone will be arrested on his next trip somewhere where he's going. But even more important from all these points is what the intelligence is telling us, that a live terrorist is worth much more than a dead terrorist. And what they do is they extract information for these wounded terrorists, which are immediately implemented. I have one of my grandsons who served in the intelligence. He doesn't tell too many things. Obviously, everything is secretive. But they can see every house and every street in Gaza sitting in Jerusalem. Today you see everything with satellites and so on. And when they extract from such a terrorist, for instance, that the house on this and this address has a bomb in it, so they right away tell the soldiers that are supposed to attack this building to be careful that there is a bomb there. And we know it only because this terrorist was interrogated this minute before the soldiers entered this house. So it is a very, very valuable information, and therefore it's preferable to keep him alive and get this information than just let him die. Okay, he'll die, but we are losing a lot of intelligence. So, on the other hand, it's very hard for a medical team to treat such terrorists, and nurses have it worse than physicians. We as physicians make rounds, we give orders, and we leave the place. The nurses have to stay with them 24/7 and treat them and give them a medication and assist in operations and so on. For them, it's really terrible. So what Israel did, now it's not a secret anymore, so I can tell, Israel erected a special hospital in a place called Zde Teiman near Be'er Sheva, and there are currently about 200 wounded terrorists in this hospital. They recruited physicians and nurses as soldiers, so that they have to treat, well, it doesn't matter what they want, it's an older now, it's not a civilian that can come to work or not come to work. They are now soldiers, and they are treating those terrorists. And in fact, there were serious ethical questions that this medical team has asked about treating certain terrorists. And just last week, before we left to come here, the Ministry of Health appointed a special ethics committee for this hospital. I'm a member of this committee, and we are supposed to answer ethical questions that come up by treating these terrorists. So it is a problem. There is a solution, hopefully the right solution, and that is how it's being operated. Another issue which became very advanced from a scientific point of view is identifying dead bodies. And as you know, DNA can be extracted from any part of the body, from the hair, from the bone, from the skin, anything that we find, we can extract DNA. And for instance, those who were murdered in the surrounding of Gaza, Zaka collected all the parts that they saw, bones, skin, anything that they found, and parts of bodies. If it was a soldier, it came to the military identifying process in a camp called Shua, where the military chief rabbinate resides. And if it's a civilian, it came to the National Forensic Institute in Abu Kabir. And by now, all were identified. There's no person now that we don't know who he is and what happened to him. But that took a long time, because if you find a bone, if you find a bone of a finger, let's say you identify the DNA of this bone, does it mean that the person that the bone came from is alive or dead? Doesn't mean anything. He can lose the finger and still be alive. So the fact that you identify the bone of a finger doesn't tell you that he's really dead. So you need a bone that, if it's missing, the person can't live. For instance, a skull or a spine. It was a very, very detailed process of identifying, and you need something to compare to. You can extract the DNA, but who does this DNA belong depends if you can identify it. So the best is to identify to the same person. Let's say that he has a hairbrush at home. You take DNA from the hair that we know belongs to him, and you take DNA from the bone that you found somewhere, and if it matches, you know that this is the person. But unfortunately, they burned the houses as well. So there were no reference identifying pieces to identify. So you need to do it in comparison with relatives, but you have to know who he is that you suspect in order to find a relative of who you think he is. So it's a very, very complicated process, but as I said, all were identified. What was unique of this war, and from a medical point of view, it was the first time in history that some were diagnosed dead without the body. Because what happened was that the terrorists took people to Gaza, either already dead, and they brought them to Gaza, or they brought them to Gaza and they killed them, or they died there. So we don't have any body. And yet, from intelligence information, we could identify everyone who was even taken there without their body, that we can examine a DNA or a picture or whatever. So that is a very, very important part of this particular war. A few words about Charles. As we said, Pikuach Nefesh is By Pikuach Nefesh, you're allowed to buy on the Shabbos, the physicians in this room, myself, we violate Shabbos many times, because if we have to treat the patient, Pikuach Nefesh is Doich Shabbos. So the war certainly is Doich Shabbos. You're allowed to go to war on Shabbos, you're allowed to fight on Shabbos, which, by the way, historically was something new. It wasn't so all along. The Hashmonaim didn't accept the fact that you're allowed to violate Shabbos for war. And they fought until Shabbos. Then they went into a cave. They thought no one would see them. And they didn't touch the souls because it's Muktzeh. And they just sat there quietly over Shabbos and then resumed war. The Greek found out that this is the policy. They found them and they killed all of them and they didn't return the fight because they thought you're not allowed to violate Shabbos even for Pikuach Nefesh. That has changed in the Talmudic time, and we learn that during war you're allowed to violate Shabbos in order to return the war. An interesting question that came up in this war was that it was quite prolonged, and people, soldiers and officers, were in Gaza for a month, sometimes even 2 months at a time. And that is very, very difficult for a person to be all the time in the war. They didn't have showers, the food wasn't as they are used to, and they are fighting, and they have to guard themselves, and they are not sleeping. Very difficult. So, at some point they made rounds that people could go out for refreshment and stay 24 hours at home, if they are married to their wives, if they are single with their parents or their brothers, and they go out from the war. Now, if they go out on a weekday, no problem. But sometimes they have to return on Shabbos. So that also is no problem because they are returning to a Pikuach Nefesh situation. The same as a physician is allowed to drive on Shabbos to the hospital to take care of a patient. But what about the situation where he is going out on Shabbos just for refreshment? That, from a Pikuach Nefesh standpoint, is irrelevant. He's going home. He's not going to the war. Is he allowed to drive on Shabbos from the war home on Shabbos? And the answer given by all the poskim that discussed this matter in this particular war is yes. That is part of what the war per se allows to violate. You can't be a good soldier if you won't go out for refreshment. If you continue being there in this condition, you won't be the same good soldier as you will be if you have the opportunity to come home and to take a shower, to be with your wife, to be with your parents, with your family, and then come back with new power, with new coins. So that is something that by Pikuach Nefesh standards wouldn't be allowed. But because it's a war, it has a different halacha. The last here on the list is something theoretical and hopefully will not materialize, but there are rumors that some of the women who are in captivity were raped and they are pregnant. And the question will be, hopefully, when they return, would they be allowed to abort or not? I don't want to go into it. It's a very delicate question. We just now had a big discussion, a convention in the ethics of the Ministry of Health. What would we do if they return? By the Israeli law, there is a distinction between up to 24 weeks of gestation and 24 weeks and up. The reason is that up to 24 weeks, it's a non-viable baby, a fetus, and from 24 weeks on, it's viable. So the laws, I'm not talking about halacha, but the law of the land is that there's a difference between a permit, committing abortion before viability and after. If you calculate the 7th of October, let's say that the woman was raped on the 7th of October and became pregnant on the 7th of October, we still don't have 24 weeks. So if they return now pregnant, they are prior to viability. That might be a little easier from the Israeli law, but we don't know when they'll come back. We don't know if the pregnancy will hold on. It's a very, very complicated situation. Okay, there are many, many halachas. I don't want to keep you up all night. I think I gave you some feeling of what we are up to regarding war and halachas. Some are ancient questions, some are new questions. And now we are gathering all this material and hopefully we can publish what we think is the right thing to do from a halachic point of view. But all the sources on which the Poskim are taking the lead on how to deal with these issues can be found in the book that we composed called Milchama Leor Halacha, Milchama in Light of Halacha. We didn't include there yet the newer questions. We included all the sources that you can base yourself on them in order to rule on such issues. As Benny told you, the military rabbinate requested 2,500 copies to distribute to all the rabbinic to all the military rabbis, to all the shuls of the army. Incidentally, we got pictures from this book in Gaza. There is here and there a little shul that people can have time to daven, and it ended up even in Gaza, so that whoever was interested could learn in his spare time between shooting one bullet and the other, to learn something that is spiritual and is helpful to understand how war should be conducted. And there's a demand for more and more, and we are trying to donate more and more books, and perhaps with the help of a few and others, we can do it for more and more soldiers. Shabbat.